This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A bit later, we'll be talking about the upcoming lunar eclipse. But first, music and your brain. When William Congreve wrote that music has charms to soothe a savage breast, his words struck a concordant note in all of us, the ability of music to affect our moods. What is it about music that, like a switch, can bring such joy as to set your toe a-tapping, or such sorrow, the memory of your high school sweetheart taking back his class ring? It's not too much work for your brain to start those tear ducts flowing. Time to get up and turn the radio to a different radio station. So how does all of this processing take place so quickly? And where in the brain does it happen? And why? Why is the brain, and by extension our emotions? Why are we so sensitive to music's charms? What in our evolutionary history would make music so important to survival? Until recently, scientists could only learn about these processes by studying patients who had lost part of their brain function. But now, using computerized imaging, they can actually see into the brain as it is working, as people are actually listening to music and watching the brain light up. And that's what we'll be talking about this hour. If you wonder about the power of music yourself, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Peter Janeda is a research assistant professor at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. He joins us from the campus there. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Janeda.
Thank you.
Mark Tramo, is a neurologist, a neuroscientist, a musician. He does lots of stuff. He's a composer, and he's at the Institute for Music and Brain Science at Harvard Med School in Cambridge, and he joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Tramo.
Greetings, Eric.
Greetings to you. You know, Dr. Tramo, it seems like we know so little about how we hear compared to how we see and other things like that, correct?
I think if you were to do a PsycINFO or Medline search on vision as opposed to audition, particularly in the neurobiology literature, you would see that the number of publications, particularly in reputable peer-reviewed journals, far outnumbers vision versus hearing.
So what happens? Tell us about the miracle of hearing. How do sounds get transformed magically into signals and feelings in our brain?
Well, the first things that happen in the ear itself is what happens when you shine light through a prism. You can think of it in that sense. So that all of the different sound frequencies we can hear are separated, like colors in the rainbow. And those different frequencies of sound are represented in different parts of the peripheral auditory system. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, once that happens, there's no more sound. There's no sound inside your auditory nerve or in your brain. It's not acoustic at all. It's entirely in the form of neural signals. So what must that code be? How can we crack the code to find out how the brain represents music?
Wow, that is some code. Can you just stick an electrode in there and listen to it?
Well, there are many ways to do this, and Peter's work at Dartmouth is one of the exciting methods that are being used, looking at how regions of the brain utilize oxygen. So when they work more, when they need to work harder, they need more food. And for neurons in your brain, that means oxygen and glucose. And by measuring the amount of blood that's flowing in tiny little capillaries that supply little parts of your brain, imaging scientists are able to tell us which parts of the brain are active. And that's a very exciting area of research right now in music perception.
Let's talk about it, Peter. You tell us about the study that you recently published in Science. You had participants listen to a certain piece of music. I think we're going to play a part of it right here.
Okay.
Now, what are we listening to, Peter?
You're listening to a melody that was composed by a Dartmouth undergrad, Jeffrey Burke. And this melody moves systematically through all 24 major and minor keys. So another way of thinking about it is that it moves throughout musical space. It kind of takes a listener's mind on a journey through all 24 keys. The what we're listening to here, the melody dwells in each key for about 20 seconds, and then it shifts over to the next key. So the duration of this clip is about 1 minute, so it only moves through three keys.
And so you're watching the activities of the brains of these people as they're listening to this music?
Correct. So we recruited 8 musically trained subjects, and we had them in the scanner, and they were listening to this melody, which actually goes on for about 8 minutes. And while they were listening, they were doing one of 2 different tasks. They were either detecting notes that we had embedded in there that would pop out in some keys and blend into others. And so when the notes popped out because they didn't belong to the key that the melody was in, so it was kind of like a wrong note or a pianist hitting a wrong note, subjects responded when that happened. Or in the other task, we just changed some of the notes to have a flute-like sound instead of that clarinet-like sound. And so subjects had to detect that change in timbre.
Uh-huh. And so people listened to this music over and over again. And what did you learn from playing this while you watched their brains light up?
Well, what we could do is that we were able to mathematically describe how this music is activating sort of a geometric structure which underlies our ability to detect when a wrong note is played. And so because we had a very precise description of the melody, we could compare our description of the melody and how it changes through time with the activation in the activation patterns in the brain, which are also changing through time. So you can sort of think of these 2 waveforms that are changing through time, and now you can compare them through a process called correlation to ask how similar they are. And so for parts of the brain whose activity patterns were very similar to the activity patterns on our musical model, if you will, we could then infer that those parts of the brain were sensitive to the structure in the melody, and then through some additional processing steps, we could sort of determine whether or not specific parts within these circuits were more sensitive to some keys than to others.
And so you found different parts of the brain lighting up for different melodies or keys?
In this experiment, we just use this melody over and over. As is the case in many scientific experiments, one has to repeat a particular stimulus or condition many, many times in order to get enough signal, as it were, so as to, establish reliability of the observation. So we also scanned the listeners on separate occasions about a week apart so that we could establish reliability that way. And what we observed was that within any given listener, a very stable circuit in each listener's brain was correlated with the musical stimulus moving through all the keys. And so we could look at it both in individuals and then also across individual listeners to, mm-hmm. identify what parts of the brain were most active.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about music this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday. If you'd like to join in, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Mark, does music exist in every culture? Do people hear the same music? We know that they have different musics for different cultures, but is it innate? Why is it so different? Could you take one person out of one culture and they hear their toes would be tapping to another kind of music?
It's a fascinating question, Ira, and reminiscent of your introduction when you mentioned the evolutionary questions as well. We know that, for example, in speech, there clearly are a lot of music-like cues in your ability to understand what I mean when I say something. The cliche, it's not what you say, but how you say it. The auditory mechanisms that hold that cliche true are the very same sorts of mechanisms that we use, for example, in processing a melody line, in recognizing a familiar melody that is dear to us. We have mechanisms within our auditory system that allow us to see these patterns. And every culture in the world certainly has music. The form that it can take is different from culture to culture, but it does appear that different cultures are picking up on very basic aspects of music, like a note, a pitch. How high or low is this note? And is the next one higher or lower than that one? And in the sequence, do they make a pretty little combination for that particular culture? So we have to have, like animals, auditory mechanisms that can extract pitch information from the environment.
And so in our culture, in the Western society, we have an octave, right? Eight notes?
Yeah, one of the universals is that all cultures appear to structure their notes in octaves. So, you know, A is A, whether it's this octave or that octave, and that nomenclature reflects the perceptual similarity of two A's. Let's play one on one octave, one on another octave. There's a perceptual similarity in those two notes that is recognized all over the world, and that's what we use to then chunk pitch information into scales, like the diatonic scale in the West, for example, or pentatonic much in the East. So that those number of notes are chunked, and we can deal with the amount of information within each octave and then information across octaves. It's like a challenge for our brains. Can we keep up with the music? Can we structure it? And it's through that structuring that we can extract the emotion and meaning that you were talking about initially.
So you're talking about a hard wiring that's in our brain some way.
Well, certainly the auditory system is hardwired. It develops in particular ways given some basic normal acoustic environment. How different cultures use different cues in their music varies, but we all have certain limitations as humans. And one of my favorite experiments, I'm sure Peter knows quite well, George Miller's classic work on the magic number 7, plus or minus 2, that regardless of whether we're talking about colored lights or taps on the skin or tones in an octave, that we have a limit in the number of bits of information we can process in that modality. And isn't it amazing that the most common scales in music around the world are the 7-note diatonic scale and the 5-note pentatonic scale, well within Professor Miller's 7 plus or minus 2.
And this is without the cultures ever knowing about one another.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. And for example, why do some of the greatest songwriters of the 20th century, Irving Berlin, Stevie Wonder, Lennon and McCartney, how could they be such great songwriters if they were illiterate? Well, the knowledge that we have about music within our culture in many ways is implicit. And investigators like Peter and myself are very interested in looking at the brain mechanisms that are involved when we process that information so automatically.
Huh. All right, we're going to take a short break. We're talking with Peter Giannata and Mark Tramo, both the people who research music and how it affects our brains, and we're going to take a short break. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about music and the brain with my guest, Peter Giannata, Research Associate Assistant Professor at Dartmouth College. Mark Tramo, neurologist, neuroscientist, musician, composer, and director of the Institute for Music and Brain Science at Harvard Med School. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Peter, I noticed from your research that you discovered that the area in the brain where the music registers, the music goes round and round, so to speak, is the same area where memories are. And that sort of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, one thing to keep in mind is that music and most of the stimuli we encounter in our world are very broadly processed in the brain. And so I think it's fairly difficult to talk about, a single region that would process music or even represent musical memory. So also memories are quite distributed. But we did, in fact, observe an interesting region of the brain that tracked activity of the music as it moved. And it's a part of the brain called the medial prefrontal cortex or the rostromedial prefrontal cortex. And it's been proposed by other researchers to be an area where various types of memories are combined, and also an area of the brain that is very much involved in introspective type of thinking. So when we're assimilating what a particular stimulus or particular environmental experience means to us, this part of the brain is very active.
Where is the location? And I imagine this is one of the questions you're asking. Where a music can it suddenly evoke a tremendous emotional feeling in us? How does that happen?
Well, that's still a very good question, very much under study. There's some very nice work by Anne Blood and Robert Zatori looking at people experiencing musical chills. So when you hear a piece of music that sends a shiver down your spine, what part of the brain does that activate? Well, so people know that there is circuitry that is involved with emotional processing. And one part of this circuit are these parts of the prefrontal cortex, sort of all the way in the very front of your brain, sort of between your eyes, as it were, so just right behind your forehead. And so those areas, again, because they seem to represent many different pieces of information, including the structures that allow us to perceive how music moves, it may be in these regions that sort of the perceptual information, if you will, is bound together with emotional information. Mm-hmm. But, this is still early days in elucidating all the mechanisms by which that happens.
Mm-hmm. Mark Tramo, how early in life do we become music critics? I mean, as young babies, do we show certain preferences for music, that we hate? I hate the Beatles, I'll take Bach, something like that.
Right, and it's probably a misconception that there's something special about Mozart. It really
it's a misconception.
Becomes an issue of how early can scientists really demonstrate in the laboratory setting the kinds of preferences that you and I are talking about as adults. Mm-hmm. And there's a rich literature in developmental psychology. Major contributors include Sandy Trehub and Laura Trainer. My colleague here, Jerry Kagan, did a study with some four-month-old infants that suggested they felt that minor seconds, which let's go to an example of Twinkle Twinkle. So if we were to play something like this, four-month-olds sitting on their mom's laps, they wouldn't get too fussy, they wouldn't move around too much and be fidgety, and they would tend to look at this kind of bullseye, which was covering the loudspeaker. But if Zentner and Kagan presented a version that sounded like this, all hell broke loose, and the kids, some of them were crying, some of them were turning away. The length of time that they looked at this loudspeaker that was covered by a bullseye was significantly less when the melody was built up of these dissonant minor seconds. So is there something that maybe, we all can hear in the womb. Mm-hmm. We hear from about halfway through our development in the womb. It doesn't sound like a keyboard. I mean, it's very noisy. It's kind of like low-pass filtered noise. So like, and of course, then you have the heartbeat with boom. So that's sort of that's your acoustic environment, let's say the first 4 to 5 months or so of your existence. and how much of that preference might reflect what your mom listens to and likes? Well, you know, there's some evidence that that might be the case, too. So fascinating questions. Developmental psychology and ethnomusicology, those fields are really helping to address this issue of universality that we find so relevant to understanding biology.
And we all know that certain musics can make us, you know, feel better. Actually, I find that if I'm listening to the right kind of music when I'm on my treadmill or working out in my gym, I do much better. It's as thin, you know?
Yeah, there are some compelling arguments for how that occurs. And a classic work in the field is Leonard Meyer's book on emotion and meaning in music. And the idea is this. The brain has different departments. There's a hearing department, there's a seeing department, there's a moving department. And then there are these other areas of the brain that have to do with emotions, or what you and I consider to be our personality or aesthetics, and difficult to define a brain phenomena. So you can derive meaning and emotion in music typically in two routes. If you're a very sophisticated musician, you might actually find a lot of emotional valence in subtle manipulations of melodic, harmonic, and rhythmic progressions of a new composition. And that's a very heavily auditory-weighted way of appreciating music. On the other hand, you may be someone who really enjoys dancing to music or hanging in a mosh pit and jumping up and down when music is being played. And that sort of emotion is generated not only by the auditory processing, but by the social context, the associated visual cues, the associated kinesthetic cues, associations that we have with the music, like whether, you know, we were kissing for the first time when the first time we heard that song. So you can have these meaningful semantic associations in your memory, or you can have this very auditory acquired taste that's highly elaborated upon.
From an evolutionary point of view, why would we develop a taste, a likeness, or a use for music, a skill, an artwork, an art form?
I often turn to two arguments. One is the relationship between music and vocalizations. Vocal communication sounds throughout the animal kingdom are used to communicate meaning and emotions. Darwin emphasized the similarity between animal communication and musical sound. So that it's likely in the evolution of language that our early hominids, maybe even before the genus Homo, maybe back to Australopithecus, before they had this really refined articulatory apparatus that can say consonant, vowel, syllables, they were making non-speech vocalizations. In fact, Ira, you and I, when we're especially emotional, those are the times we use vocalizations and not really speech sounds. Moans, groans, sighs, crying, laughing, all of those are not truly speech sounds in the sense that linguists talk about language and syntax and Chomsky and psycholinguistics. So I think very early on there is a relationship that has to do with the communication of meaning and emotion through the auditory modality, whether it's through speech or song or rhythm or banging. That's argument one. Argument two is much more of an anthropological, sociological perspective, which is that as humans, we had to bond together and form societies and not fight each other and kill each other all the time if we were going to really make it past saber-toothed tigers. And we had to form these societies, and we needed a way to develop a collective identity, whether it be for a nation or a religion or a tribe. We needed to form these identities. There are certain icons for each group that define identities. And you just to think about our existence, have you ever been to a wedding or a funeral or a graduation where there wasn't music playing?
No, no.
Well, it has clearly a pragmatic role in what I like to think of as binding the collective ego in sort of Freudian and Jung terms that allowed humans to succeed and not get killed by stronger animals by forming groups and societies.
It's a bonding mechanism for everybody there. Peter, we always hear about music being an activity of the, quote, the right brain, the right hemisphere. But from what I'm looking at your research about where, you know, the scans were lighting up, it didn't seem like it was on the right side there.
Well, it seems to be quite bilateral, though. There was some right hemispheric bias actually in the temporal lobe, so where the auditory cortices are. But I think people are finding quite often now that music is a very bilateral activity, and also again, it's not restricted, say, just to the auditory cortices or a small number of areas. There are segregations of functions, or there's evidence for segregation of function between the two hemispheres. So the left hemisphere, the auditory cortex in the left hemisphere, seems to be somewhat better at making fine temporal discriminations, mm-hmm. which is also adaptive for processing language, whereas there's some indication that the right hemisphere is somewhat more biased towards processing pitch relationships and pitch contours or melodies. But overall, music really engages the entire brain, and I think that that's part of what makes music very powerful. So, for instance, when you're hearing a piece of music and all of a sudden you can't help but start tapping your toe or sort of dancing or singing along in your mind with it or even mm-hmm. out loud, I think all of that shows that when we perceive music and when it becomes sort of our focal experience, what we're focusing on, it recruits all the various parts of the brain that are involved in auditory perception that have to do with memory, and also parts of the brain that have to do with producing actions.
So your motor functions are tied right in there also.
That's right. That's right.
And it's almost reflexive.
That's the funny thing. I give a talk where I show a 1-minute clip of my young daughter who's not quite 2 years old, and the clip shows, you know, you hear a piece of music playing and she just immediately perks up and starts dancing, even though there's nobody else in the room who's dancing, and you know, she certainly wouldn't dance if she didn't right. feel like it.
We're talking about music this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato here with Mark Jude Tramo and Peter Giannata. So let's see if we can get a phone call or two on the phones before we have to go. Let's go to Mark in Rochester. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
As a musician myself, I'm wondering, in your studies, have you found different areas of the brain when you're listening or in appreciation as opposed to when you're learning and or performing music?
We have observed that we can bias what circuits are activated depending on how people listen. Now, other people have looked more directly at brain correlates of performance, and not surprisingly, as you bias the activity towards a performance activity, then you recruit parts of the brain that are responsible for planning sequences of actions and then implementing those sequences of actions. Whereas when you're listening more passively, you're very heavily activating perceptual areas. But there is some interaction between the two, and depending on how you focus your attention or if you're trying to encode, so memorize the melody that you're hearing, you'll bias that circuitry towards areas that are more specialized for the particular thing that you're trying to do.
Okay,
I think the phenomenon Mark was touching on there was this notion of functional dissociations that has been shown repeatedly for many, many years in the case of brain damage patients. Is it possible to have damage in a particular part of the brain that affects one function more and another function less?
Mm-hmm.
And the literature is replete with examples where deficits of a variety of different forms can take place, and certainly one of them is whether the performance of music as opposed to the perception of music is impaired.
So, are you also touching on the fact that the brain that music calms us and soothes us and lowers our blood pressure? You said it's very diffuse around the brain, the effects of music. I guess this would be just another part of the brain.
Well, it's not so much diffuse as that there are a lot of different parts involved. The the systems that mediate it are very specific, but they are widespread within the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to evoke an emotion through indirect means, through conditioned responses. So if you have a positive association with a particular, it could be visual or auditory stimulus, oftentimes in our culture it really is music, then that allows you a means of escaping into that modality and reliving what you enjoy in that modality, and in a sense gating the pain or the discomfort or the anxiety or the stress that you would otherwise be attending to. So the notion that you can use stimuli, you can only process so many things at a time. Why not focus your attention on something that is pleasing to you rather than spend time on something that's unpleasant?
Do we know that music might release endorphins or other kinds of natural opiates that would calm us down?
I'm unaware of endorphin measurements, and there are issues related to the time factors involved in the increase and decrease of these humoral factors in relation to really what are instantaneous phenomena when we listen to music. But we do know, certainly by inference, that you can drop somebody's blood pressure or heart rate by starting to play music in particular settings. And those sorts of mechanisms have to be mediated by the balance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic parts of the autonomic nervous system. So there's no question music can have that effect.
We're talking with Peter Giannata of Dartmouth College and Mark Jude Ramo of Harvard Med School on Talk of the Nation. I'm Ira Flato. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato, and we're talking about the brain and music. We're going to take maybe a little question or two until we move on to another topic. 1-800-989-8255 is our number if you're interested in talking about the brain and the music. Let's see, we got one more call from Jane in Murray, Kentucky. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Just fine. This has been just absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
I was interested in the effect of music on infants. My oldest daughter, when she was just a tiny infant, I always had music going, NPR, of course, and if she would hear anything in the minor key, when she was just a tiny infant, like 3 weeks old, 4 weeks old, her little chin would start to quiver and her mouth would quiver and she'd start to cry. If it went to major, she was all right. She was sunny and bright and happy and smiley. But
how fascinating.
She was just a tiny, tiny child. And recently I've had a miniature pincher, a little min pin, and in all the American Kennel Club literature, it always says that min pins make very strange noises. And my little min pin sounds as if he's trying to vocalize. He makes very human sounds.
I know a hound that does that. So. So has your daughter still reacted the same way to music as she's grown up?
No, she hasn't. She unfortunately had a lot of problem with her ears when she was younger, and it left her partly deaf, and she's tone deaf. Mm-hmm. She loves music, and she plays the guitar, but she has trouble singing, and she doesn't enjoy it, I'm sure, as much as she would have if she had not had an ear impairment.
Well, Jane, thanks for calling and sharing this with us.
It's been a wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Gentlemen, any reaction?
Go for it, Mark.
I think Peter and I would love to meet your daughter and study her, Jane. These sorts of phenomena, I think what they point to are that even at a very early age, we can pick up on certain cues in music. Not necessarily that in some canonical way, minor means sad and major means happy, because they don't. Probably tempo and pitch height have more to do with emotion, so slow tempo, low pitch, as well as minor mode, across cultures seems to correlate more with the emotion of sadness. But nonetheless, there are lots of cues the child could be picking up on. But it's fascinating that we have this capacity so early on in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank you both for joining us this hour. It's been fascinating. Peter Giannotta, research assistant professor at Dartmouth College. Mark Jude Tramo, he is a neurologist, neuroscientist, a musician, and the director of the Institute for Music and Brain Science at Harvard Med School. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.